invitation. It's a great pleasure for me to be here. I must warn the audience that I'm trained as a philosopher, and we philosophers love to talk. I wrote 360 pages on silence. Talk about performative contradictions. But luckily, I've only been given 20 minutes, so I'm going to just jump into my arguments. So the first part of the paper is called... So the first part of the paper is called One World, One Pain? In recent years, an increasing number of global citizens' movements have taken justice as their explicit goal. At issue here are the scope and scale of struggles for justice. In contrast to those who are committed to domestic justice and contribute to the well-being of their immediate communities and fellow citizens, theorists and activists in the field of transnational justice argue for a broader and deeper commitment that would encompass strangers both within and beyond state borders. In an increasingly globalized world, the lives of people who have never met and who will possibly never meet are nonetheless intimately connected, so that our duties and responsibilities are not limited to our fellow citizens. It is claimed that contemporary cosmopolitanism facilitates new alliances across state borders, regions, and even continents, thereby contesting patriotism and nationalism. The notion of cosmopolitanism was first advanced by the founding father of the Cynic movement, Diogenes of Sinope, who, when asked where he came from, answered, so he made this really grand statement, "I am a citizen of the world." And just a footnote here, as we know, Diogenes was shaming Plato for his provinciality and his limited understanding of the demos and his focus on the polis. So he was like trying to tell, you know, Plato, you're a little frog in the well. I have traveled outside Athens, and I know that there is a world that exists out of Athens, outside Athens, and I am a citizen of this world. Taking inspiration from Greek thinkers, philosophers of European Enlightenment augmented the importance of this sentiment in their political and ethical theories. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, for example, professed that cosmopolites are people who are nowhere strangers and are able, and I'm quoting Rousseau here, to cross the imaginary boundaries that separate peoples and embrace the whole of mankind in their benevolence. More recently, in her book, Cultivating Humanity, Martha Nussbaum writes, and I quote her, "The world around us is inescapably international. Issues from business to agriculture, from human rights to the relief of famine, call our imaginations to venture beyond narrow group loyalties and to consider the reality of distant lives. Cultivating our humanity in a complex interlocking world involves understanding the ways in which common needs and aims are differently realized in different circumstances." End of quote. The emphasis here is on the urgency of acting in the face of suffering of others. It is overcoming apathy and indifference by realizing that we are not immune to the pain of others. One frequently encounters images and narratives of grief, misery, and misfortune. And because we are nowadays flooded with these images and narratives, one is also again and again encountering this term empathy fatigue or compassion fatigue, where people say, you know, I can't help everybody, so, or even if I try to help people, I'll be only end up being accused of being imperialist, so I'd rather not help. And here the question arises whether media or art can facilitate compassion and ethics. And let me share with you all two quick examples of where this has been tried. So the first example is from Martha Rosler, who's an American artist. And what Rosler tries to do in her work, particularly these series called House Beautiful, Bringing the War Home, is to juxtapose privileges, entitlement against suffering and anguish elsewhere. So we see happy American families enjoying suburban bliss, even as there's bloodshed and chaos and suffering in the background. And Rosler's commentary on the obliviousness, she's particularly also talking about historically the Vietnam War and more recently the Iraq War. So she's trying to show the interconnectedness between the entitlements here and suffering elsewhere. So this is the first image. The second one, the selfie generation. The third one, I of course had to think about imperialist feminism or Ivanka Trump feminism. And when I first saw Rosler's images, I had to think of this quote by Mark Twain, who says, "God invented war so that Americans can learn geography." The second example is from Kevin Carter. Kevin Carter was a South African photographer, and this image that I'm going to share with you in a minute is from 1993 when he was on a trip to Sudan where there was this horrible famine, and he was about to photograph a toddler who was crawling towards the feeding center, and a vulture, a hooded vulture, landed close by, and Kevin Carter was told by aid workers not to touch this kid because of fears of contamination. And Carter tells us the story that he took the photograph and then he shoot the vulture away. I'm going to show you the image, but I must warn you that it is a distressing image. So that's the image. He sold it to the New York Times and went on to win the Pulitzer Prize for it. Unfortunately, and New York Times got, you know, thousands of phone calls inquiring about what happened to the little girl. We don't know what happened to the little girl. We don't know if the girl survived. What we do know is Kevin Carter committed suicide a few months later, saying he couldn't go on doing what he was doing. At first sight, there seems to be nothing blameworthy about the demand that we, as citizens of affluent liberal democracies, take on responsibilities beyond the limits of our narrow self-interest. Cosmopolitanism, based on the normative espousal of an expansive global consciousness, opposes any form of limited territorial loyalties. The German sociologist Ulrich Beck points out that because we live in an increasingly interdependent world, we face common threats to our ecologies, finances, and security, so that violation of rights in one part of the world is felt everywhere. This, what he calls globalization of risk, unites us in our equal vulnerability, providing the basis for the cosmopolitan moment of a world risk society, also Weltrisikogesellschaft. Beck discusses what he calls a globalization of compassion, which offsets this globalization of risks, spectacularly demonstrated by the unprecedented readiness of citizens in faraway countries to donate to relief efforts. Beck endorses what he calls a cosmopolitan realpolitik, viewing global institutions such as the United Nations and International Criminal Court, as well as global NGOs and transnational social movements, as legitimate vanguards of a just alter-globalization. Now, although Nussbaum and Beck enthusiastically endorse cosmopolitanism as a solution for past injustices and a promise of better times to come, I object to the project of cosmopolitanism because it fails to seriously address the historical processes through which certain individuals are placed in a situation from which they can aspire to global solidarity and universal benevolence. So to put it in more simple terms, I'm certainly interested in dualisms like former colonized, colonizer, black and white, Orient and Occident, queer and straight, rest and the West. But in this context, I'm particularly interested in the discontinuity between those who give, dispense rights, justice, aids, and those who receive rights, justice, aid. Beck proposes that our common vulnerability, and I like the German word Verletzlichkeit, that our common vulnerability in the face of risk brings us together. But as we all know, and thank you for quoting me on that, we might be facing the same storm, but we are not all in the same boat, and that makes all the difference. So just to share with you where I got this metaphor, actually, Kofi Annan was at this Copenhagen climate talks, and he came out of these talks and gave this interview where he used the metaphor, and he says, we have to respond to the ecological crisis because we are all sitting in the same boat. And in that moment, I thought, no, Kofi, and just a clarification, I'm not on first name basis with Kofi Annan. That was all happening in my head, and I was like, no, Kofi, we might be facing the same storm, but we're not all in the same boat, and that makes a difference. Remember the Titanic, and your survival chances dependent on where you were on the Titanic? So to wrap up the first section, for me, the imperative question is, how does the pain of others make us ethical? And I will come back to this in the end. And I'd like just to, because I don't have references to give here, but I have the reference in my written text, I'd like to give a little reference here because I mentioned Susan Zontag, but I also take inspiration from Maria do Mar Castro Varela, who kind of brought to my notice this idea also of the connection between ethics and suffering of others. Now, before I move on to my second section, just a quick footnote to clarify my critique of cosmopolitanism. Now, the pejorative sense of cosmopolitanism actually has its origins in German anti-Semitic discourse. The rootless Jew was seen as a cosmopolitan citizen from nowhere. Similarly, from 1948 to 1953, Joseph Stalin led an anti-cosmopolitan campaign targeting Jewish intellectuals, architects, and scientists precisely as rootless cosmopolitans or cosmopolitans without a homeland, implying that cosmopolitanism was necessarily anti-patriotic. More recently, the current Prime Minister of UK, Theresa May, at the Conservative Party's annual conference remarked, and I quote her on this, "If you believe you're a citizen of the world, you're a citizen of nowhere. You don't understand what citizenship means." I'd just like to share an image with you. This is Theresa May after the Brexit. The first foreign trip that she did was to go to Bangalore and Hyderabad for bilateral discussions, and this is how she looked like. Unlike this form of anti-cosmopolitanism, which falls back on ethnic and economic nationalism, my concern comes from the unreflected construction of we the people. And the concomitant construction of the borderless planet. Now let me outline my problem with the constitution of the global demos and the tricky politics of street politics in more detail, street protests in more detail, to outline how practices and discourses of solidarity, aid, and justice can be, and to use a term from Sara Ahmed, non-performative. That means that there is a discontinuity between what is said and what happens, between rhetoric and reality. So this brings me to the second section, and then my third section is pretty short. The second section is called, and I'm sure you Berlin queers will like this, the erotics of resistance. In the past decades, there's been a proliferation of protest movements that seek to reconfigure international politics by way of interpolating a global demos that has been wronged by the neoliberal beast. From Puerta del Sol to Taksim, from Syntagma to Tahrir Square, from Hong Kong to New Delhi, street politics seem to have transformed the way power, agency, and resistance are being perceived and performed. By inserting new actors into the political stage to appropriation and resignification of political discourses, these counter-public spheres, it is argued, and this is a term, of course, that I take from Nancy Fraser, are instigating deliberation on issues of redistribution, recognition, and representation. Replacing the Habermasian idea of public sphere where rational subjects come together to deliberate over common interests, counter-publics can be read as affect worlds where public anger, outrage, frustration reshape the terms of state-civil society relation. The San Precario movement, the Arab Leones, the Indignados, the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations, the various refugee strikes against coercive migration regimes are examples of emergence of counter-movements against multiple and intersecting dynamics of injustice. Particularly going to draw on arguments presented by Judith Butler and Athana Athanasiou in their book Dispossession. So Butler and Athanasiou argue that this direct action on the streets alleges to bring together immensely heterogeneous groups, inducing what they call spontaneous solidarity. These bodies on the street are vulnerable to police force and state violence, even as they oppose their disenfranchisement and marginalization and demand accountability from their political representatives. So Butler and Athanasiou argue that the corporeality and the collectivity of the masses as they assemble to protest political and economic dispossession can be read as bodily message of popular sovereignty. And when I read Butler and Athanasiou, I had to think about this iconic image of the tank man, the Tiananmen Square protests. And when I first saw this image many, 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 many years ago, I had to think about Friedrich Nietzsche's metaphor of the state as monstre froid, the coldest of all cold monsters. Protest movements in different parts of the world evoke promises of radical political change through shaming powerful states and international political institutions into political and financial institutions into good behavior. However, the question remains, how effective are these fantasies of undoing social, political, and economic injustice in the era of post-colonial late capitalism through hashtag revolutions and Twitter insurgencies? The romantic enthusiasm evoked by these movements erases the exploitative and exclusionary material conditions that makes possible the exercise of agency of the dissidents. When, for instance, the anti-capitalist protester twitters with his or her iPad, which is produced under super exploitative working conditions in the global south, so I'm very happy about the little clip that you showed in the beginning, the phantasma of the subversion of capitalism reveals itself as a surreal moment of class-privileged jouissance. So, you know, I hope the irony of twittering your way out of capitalism is not lost on the Berlin audience here. An erotics of resistance that is marked by a new international division of labor, which sustains the discontinuities between those who resist injustice and those who cannot. So I presented similar arguments at another context, and after my talk, the first question that was raised was, did you just critique Butler? So those of you all who might be confused after my talk, yes, I did just critique Butler. And I'm sure Judith will be very, very happy with me for disagreeing with her. Foucault proposes that where there is power, there is resistance. I would argue, or I would add, where there is resistance, there is power. Now let me illustrate this with two examples to demonstrate the discontinuity between the givers and receivers of justice before I move on to my conclusion. The first film clip, please. The Delhi gang rape case incited spontaneous nationwide protests against sexual violence and the abysmal failure of the Indian state to ensure the safety of its female citizens. In a country with one of the highest incidents of rape in the world, it was unprecedented when thousands and thousands and thousands of people came out to protest the lack of safety for women in public spaces. What was unique about these protests was they were neither organized by any political party nor any institutionalized civil society, namely an NGO. As was expected, the Indian civil society was celebrated in the world media for taking to the streets, while the Indian government was sharply condemned for its violence against the protesters. And then came the unexpected part. The civil society contributed to creating an atmosphere where instant retributive justice measures such as death penalty and castration of rapists gained shrill popularity, while experts recommended technology-based criminal justice, which would involve surveillance cameras in public spaces and creating a database of sexual offenders. Now, parallel to the Delhi gang rape, 19 Dalit, so-called untouchable women, were raped in the neighboring state of Haryana, and this was not even reported in the national press. Forget the international press. So then, we have to ask ourselves, what kind of bodies have to be violated for the mobilization of the collectivity? Who is the we in whose name justice is being demanded? This demonstrates how subaltern groups are marginalized, not just by the state, but also by the civil society. This brings me to the second example. In the aftermath of the sexual assaults during the 2016 New Year's Eve celebrations, there has been a systematic demonization of all migrants and refugees as sexist and misogynist, while weakening the consensus in favor of Germany accepting a large number of refugees. It serves as a good example of the fickleness of proclamations of German welcome culture and global solidarity. So I'm going to show you all a series of images. The first one many of you all might be familiar with, Pegida. Patriotic Europeans against the Islamization of the Occident. Thank you very much. And they coined this very racist neologism, refugees not welcome. We were flooded with images like these, where the accusation against Mackel was she was more interested in protecting the rights of non-citizens than her own citizens. This was a very controversially discussed image. Respect us, we are not fair game, even when we are naked. Just a little backstory to this whole construction of the rapable white woman and the myth of the black rapist. It's interesting to note that the first genocide of the 20th century, which was committed by the Germans against the Herero Nama people, this myth of the black rapist was mobilized in a certain way to justify the genocide. And so one sees the long, you know, rich tradition of the weaponization of gender violence in legitimizing racist and imperialist discourses and narratives. I come to another interesting example, Charlie Hebdo, the embodiment of liberal free speech. After the Cologne assaults, Charlie Hebdo came up with this caricature. On the left side, your left side, the left side of the audience, on the top you see this caricature of little Alan Kurdi, the three-year-old kid who drowned and whose body was found on the beach in Turkey. And the question reads, what would have become of little Alan had he survived? And then you see two pig-faced men chasing two women, and the punchline is, ask gropers in Germany. Now, there was immediately a call. Some of the feminists came together to organize a counter-demonstration to the Pegida demonstration. This was a bit later in March. And I know this because one of my former students, I lived 6 years in Cologne, and one of my former students participated in organizing these counter-demonstrations where they put it on the agenda that feminism should not be weaponized in order to deny refugees their human rights. Now, ironically, what happened at these demonstrations was that a fight broke out between Antifa, Anti-Ra, Anti-Imp groups, and particularly female police officers. Now, because I spent a lot of time with my anarchist students in Frankfurt, I know all the cool terms. So Anti-Ra is anti-racist, Anti-Imp is anti-imperialist, and Antifa is anti-fascist. So these are mostly autonomous groups who, of course, see the state as the enemy, Staat als Feind. And because this tension broke out between these autonomous groups and particularly female police officers, a lot of refugees and migrants left this counter-demonstration because they were worried that they would get into trouble with the police. So it's a very, very instructive example about those in whose name this solidarity demonstration was taken out could not themselves participate in the demonstration. In his deconstructive reading of Kantian cosmopolitan ethics, Jacques Derrida discusses how the Kantian principle of universal hospitality, also in his text, Zum ewigen Frieden, Kant, towards perpetual peace, Kant talks about the principle of universal hospitality, but this is only temporary in nature. Kant proposes that hospitality is limited to the visitor not being treated with hostility upon arrival on someone else's territory, but upholds the right of the sovereign state to refuse entry provided this does not result in the destruction of the sojourner. So Kant differentiates between Gastrecht and Bleiberecht. He emphasizes the temporary nature of the right to hospitality with the host having the prerogative to deny rights to those who create trouble. Derrida traces elements of hostility intrinsic in Kantian reflections on hospitality and speaks about hospitality, hostile hospitality of Kant's conditional hospitality. Now, it's interesting that when Kant talks about categorical imperative, he doesn't put any conditions. He doesn't say, you know, if you're being threatened by somebody with a knife, it's okay to lie. Yeah? Categorical imperative is unconditional, but when it comes to questions of hospitality, Derrida points out in his deconstructive reading that it is conditional hospitality. And according to Derrida, a truly cosmopolitan ethics would entail absolute hospitality, which is unconditional and is not qualified upon guests fulfilling certain criteria or duties to receive it. Contrary to the European system of processing refugees and migrants, This would rest on, which rests on determining who deserves an opportunity to exist, to live, and who should receive justice and who's entitled to be here. Derrida tells us that unconditional hospitality entails, and now hold your breath, the host becoming hostage of the guest. That Europe should give up sovereignty on its territory if it truly wants to practice hospitality. That it seems to be that it is imperative to rescue the enlightened principles from the Europeans. And I'll come back, I'm happy to come back to this in the Q&A. Now let me move on to my short conclusion, and the third section is called The Death of Leviathan. I'd like to conclude by addressing the important issue of transnational cooperation and justice, justice and solidarity. The Sri Lankan feminist Malati Dayalvis asks if we are truly capable of empathizing with the pain of others, and even if we should be allowed to witness their pain, if this witnessing only serves to affirm our humanity and our capacity to care, yeah? So that we feel reassured that we are capable of caring when we witness the pain and suffering of others. Correspondingly, of course, we need to find authentic victims who truly deserve our benevolence and solidarity. Now, what do we do with our will to empower the disenfranchised and the vulnerable? And how do we deal with those who refuse to be interpolated as appropriate objects of our will to do justice? Against popular sentiments, and now I'm giving you all a little bit of an abridged version, and I'd be happy again to come back to this in the Q&A. Against popular sentiments, I would not place my faith solely in the international civil society as vanguards of justice. As argued by Antonio Gramsci and Gayatri Spivak, civil society can function as a site of consolidation of power even as it claims to resist and subvert it. Can we have the second clip, please? Okay, so I'm going to put away my post-colonial queer feminist cloak, and I'm going to turn into an absolute old-fashioned Gramscian here. Now, this Pepsi ad had to be withdrawn because there was a lot of protest against this ad because, you know, it was accused of trivializing, of course, appropriating, but also trivializing Black Lives Matter and other social movements. But, and of course, one of the offensive things about this ad is it's so explicitly heteronormative here. But I personally think that people were so provoked by this ad because actually it carries a Gramscian message. And it shows that the civil society is connected to the state by the market. which we very, very conveniently want to blur out. So I started my conclusion by saying that I would not place my faith solely in the international civil society as vanguards of justice, and that's because, as Gramsci argues, civil society cannot disable the coercive apparatus of the state, for it is linked to the state through the market. Furthermore, one gets the impression as if, and here I'm using Kant, als ob, there is a collectivity that emerges in the form of civil society that contests state injustice. However, this blurs how civil society is the site of production of hegemony and a sphere of continual process of conflict and strife where particular interests of a certain class are presented as the general interests of all. As part of Anish Kapoor's exhibition in Berlin at the Martin Gropius Bau, titled The Death of Leviathan, so my final section is inspired by Anish Kapoor's exhibition, we see a deflated PVC veil that sags its way across three rooms. Kapoor explains that the melancholic deflating piece, and I quote, speaks about the decline of the state. So this is from the flyer, being experienced in Europe and beyond. The lifeless form of the veil symbolizes the process of the withering away of the state. However, instead of liberated anarchy, this dying sculpture warns of the approaching disenfranchisement, disempowerment of its citizens. Given its contradictory conduct, where it's simultaneously emancipatory as well as coercive, postcolonial feminists are caught in an extremely ambivalent double bind vis-a-vis the state. If the state is harnessed for male hegemony, should feminists be wary of state-centered reforms, or can, and now this is the multi-billion dollar question, can the state be mobilized to promote gender justice? Can it function as a site of redress of gender inequality, even as it perpetuates gender ideologies which are founding myths of all nation states? Can shaming states into dispensing justice be a systematic queer post-colonial feminist strategy? The gendered implications of the erosions of state sovereignty need to be seriously considered. Despite the critique of the state, so this is where I am with those who critique the state, for its abdication of responsibility vis-a-vis its most vulnerable citizens, I find the recent rise of state-phobic discourses, and I take the term state phobia from Michel Foucault, extremely disturbing. So contra Friedrich Nietzsche's idea of the state as monstre frua, the coldest of all cold monsters, I see the state more like Jacques Derrida's pharmacon, both poison as well as medicine. Source of injustice, but also the motor for justice. In India, we have a joke. The only democratic right the Indians take great pleasure in exercising is the right to criticize the government. All other rights are considered colonial hangover. In that spirit, the struggle for justice in the era of neoliberal globalization does not lie beyond the state, but in its reconfiguration. And here I see the state as an extremely central legacy of European enlightenment. So for me, struggle for justice does not lie beyond the state, but in its reconfiguration to make it serve the interests of disenfranchised subaltern classes. To do this, we must move away from demonizing the state as monstre frua to approaching it as pharmacon. The challenge is, how do we transform poison into medicine, into counterpoison, also gift into Gegengift? Thank you for your attention.